And now go. Okay. Recording.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I love about technology, at least. You can find things fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Just don't always work. As you want it to work. Alright, so we got stats and then. Oh, I do have interlinear as well. We got a map. So I think we're good to go. Okay, Greeks there. I think we're to the end of 14, right?
24.
All right, so 24 through 28. Somebody would read those for us, please. Verses 24 through 28. Thank you, Joan.
They passed through the Salida and came to Pamphylia. And when they had spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Apollonia. From there they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the works that they had fulfilled. And when they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God had done with them and how he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles, and they remained no little time with the disciples.
Okay, good. So going back previously, they were in Derbe, right, where they were doing a lot of good proclamation of the gospel. Jews from Iconium and Lystra hunted them down, found them, caused problems for them. So Paul and Barnabas then leave Derbe and they start heading back the way they came through Lystra and Iconium. Verses 24 and following pick back up here, passing through Pisidia. So this is the region here where Pisidia and Antioch is. So they come back down through and to Pamphylia, Perga, where they were at before as well. So why are they doing this? Going back on a repeat visit. Joan?
All right, thanks to strengthen the church. Good. Make sure they're all right.
Yeah, check things out. Why so quickly after they were just there? Yeah, this is not brand new, but very new for a lot of the churches and for a lot of the Christians in those areas. And so we're going to come up with in the next chapter, Acts 15, kind of some of the headaches that arise for the early church in dealing with their history as Jews. How does this play out now for us as Christians? What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to follow? What do we get rid of? Things like that. We're trying to figure all this stuff out. And so no doubt Paul and Barnabas realize there's going to be conflicts. So you've got opposition already following them. So chances are Jews are already popping up in those locations as well to challenge the young faith of these Christians in these Gentile lands. So they're going to go back and revisit these places as they're heading back home, ultimately to Jerusalem, or at least their Syrian Antioch. Any questions, comments on that? I see a hand. Okay. So they're going through then Pamphylia, and they had spoken the word in Perga. Okay, so Perga down here near the coast again. They head over to Attalia, which is there on the left, west of Perga. Okay, and from there then they sail back to Antioch, which is Syrian Antioch. So again, we have Pisidian Antioch and we have Syrian Antioch. Syrian Antioch is the home of the church, apart from Jerusalem. This is where a lot of the Christians are. This is where Barnabas was sent to go early on. Barnabas then recruits Paul, who's back in Tarsus at the time, gets him to come down and help teach those Christians in Antioch before they're sent out by that church on this missionary journey to Cyprus and into this southern region of Asia Minor. And then they head back to Antioch to report on all that they were able to accomplish. Okay, so this is kind of the route that Paul and Barnabas have taken. And they say there in verse 26, Antioch is where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work that they had fulfilled. They arrived and gathered the church together, declared all that God had done with them, how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. Antioch at that time, they say, could be up to 250,000 people, which is very large in that area, a lot of them being former Jews, or a lot of them being Jews, and many of them now becoming Christians. Okay, so Antioch is one of the big centers of Christianity early on, so much so that once you get a few decades down the road and into the next century and beyond, you have bishops put in charge of the large grouping of churches in different areas. Jerusalem has a bishop. Antioch will have a bishop. Alexandria will have a bishop down in northern Africa, and Rome will have a bishop as well in Italy. Okay, so it's out of these, and you have equal bishops all of these over all these areas. But as more and more attention gets drawn to the one in Rome, this is where they finally determine this is the chief bishop and give him the title of Papa or Pope in the Italian. Okay, so there's no Pope initially over all of them. But the argument will come later on that, well, the Pope in Rome has ultimately come out of the descendancy or the passing on of the faith from Peter himself, probably because Peter ends up in Rome, okay, and ultimately will end up dying there as well. Okay, so that's probably the connection that they'll make, but Peter himself never claimed that spot, and never was, I don't think, a call to bishop over the church either. Those are titles given out later on. He was definitely an apostle, as was Paul, but not given the title of bishop in that sense. Okay. So all that's still coming down the road, but this is kind of, again, precursor to all that. Paul's work early on here, just in the northeastern corner of the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, the middle of the Earthen Sea, right? Mediterranean Sea, okay? So that's the Great Sea that they're working with at this point, and they're proclaiming now in Syria and Antioch, again, all that God has allowed them to do, opening the door to the Gentiles, remaining no little time with the disciples. So it's a fancy way of saying.
Yep.
They stayed there a long time, right? Anyway, so that's good Greek for you. Why this area does Paul and Barnabas focus on first?
That's the Gentile area.
It's Gentile. A lot of Gentile area all throughout the world.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to get to, maybe.
Okay. So from, especially if they're in Antioch, they're not going too far, right? And just mainly this area. It doesn't look too big. I'm sure it's several hundred miles from one place to the other. Okay, but it's just that little pocket for right now. That's going to serve as a great gateway back out further into the Western world as well. Okay, so they're going to go back and revisit some of these churches. They'll be able to use them as kind of regrouping points as well along the way so that they can have a place to go and not have to travel quite so far in one big chunk. They can stop in these places, have fellowship, rebuild, encourage, strengthen, and then move on from there, gaining support from all these places as well. Yeah, John?
Actually, you know, when it wasn't this trip, but the Lord called them to go to Macedonia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's coming up, so it'll definitely be a call, and that's why they continue
so
on.
The Lord actually probably directed them.
Beyond that, yeah. And you've got Paul continually saying, having a desire to get out to the Gentiles. And his ultimate goal, I mean, later on, I think we hear this, we don't hear it yet, but he wants to get all the way to Spain. Okay, but that's, I don't think he ever quite gets there. But he does get to Rome. He does want to get there. So he has that desire to keep going west as far as he can. Okay, but notice here, what do our missionaries today do before they go out into their field?
Train.
Hmm?
They train.
They train. They're certainly, so they got to be educated to proclaim the gospel. Before they can go out, though, what do?
Get shots.
Depending on where they go.
Hopefully they pray a lot.
Well, praying a lot. Yes. Definitely.
Also seek support from the people.
Yeah, I'm going to say, look at the money.
That's a big thing that they've got to do. They go around to all the different churches in the country, not every single one, but the ones where they feel like they have a connection already, and they seek support and prayer and help in the ministry there. So it's not unlike what Paul and Barnabas are doing here as well. They're seeking to establish connections early on, places that they can go back to so that they can have that support, that prayer. And it's not just, ooh, we're using them to get to these other people. There is a care and there is a concern there. But it will also have that double effect of being able to help them move forward and farther out into the world. Yeah, this is, you know, same thing with, I guess, nowadays the world is much more smaller, right? So you can have communication with different spots, get to different places without a lot of stopping points in between. But you're trying to get out west from the east way back when, before you had the ability to fly over the country, and you couldn't just go from one spot to the other in one long trek. You had to have stopping points along the way to regroup, to refresh, recharge, to resupply, all those types of things. The same is true in this kind of a sense as well. They have these outposts, these churches they've established for the sake of the gospel. They'll also help out in moving farther and farther west as well. And this is what Scripture is focused on, the New Testament focuses on, is this movement through the northeast of Asia Minor, or, well, I guess southeast of Asia Minor, and then into Europe over here. But we would assume that other movements are going on at the same time in different parts of that area of that world, too. The gospel, of course, gets down into northern Africa. Again, Alexandria becomes a head post for Christianity down there. The eunuch from Ethiopia, no doubt, took the gospel back down to that continent as well. So Christianity spreads that way, and probably out farther east too. Paul doesn't go that direction so much, but we do have stories of Thomas making it all the way to India, okay, and bringing the gospel there to the people. And so you can imagine then these other apostles are probably involved in certain things like that too, even though the scriptures don't record those things. Okay, but the gospel, no less, is spreading to all these known regions and these known worlds. It's easier for them to do this as well at this time because of what was called the Pax Romana, right? The Roman Empire was at a time of peace. When you're at a time of peace, not so much money goes into military and protection, but infrastructure. So they're able to improve the roadways and traveling systems that were in place. Again, you don't have vehicles, cars, but you do have an ability to make paths better, safer to travel, faster to go about, and so they were able to get to and from areas a lot more smoothly than they might have been in previous centuries. That's a result of, again, God using the secular world, to benefit the gospel and the movement of the faith throughout the world. Okay, so God is good there. Same, we can see that today too, right? Instant communication. Well, we don't just let the world do whatever it wants with the internet. We take advantage of that too. So we have blogs, we have our Synod website, we have our video posts, and all these different things we can get out into the world as well. And one of the biggest ones earlier in this, the 1900s, was Lutheran Hour Ministries, right? Get the gospel proclaimed on the radio, and get it proclaimed in all the country, and then even all throughout the world. That was a way of taking advantage of technology that wasn't intended for the church's use primarily, but the church says, hey, we can use that as well. Okay, so good things indeed come forth from the advancements of the secular world, so we can capitalize on that. Yeah.
Couple questions.
Yep.
So Paul took a lot of offerings back to Jerusalem, didn't he? So
different times, yeah.
Yeah. Were they doing that because there wasn't like a big church in Jerusalem? But was he giving it to like to Peter or James, or to send out other people? Is that what they were doing?
I don't know for sure. I don't know what the size of the church is in Jerusalem. I wouldn't say it was too small, because that's, again, the starting point of all this. And the 12 apostles remain there for the most part. At least that's the idea we get from the book of Acts. So I would guess that they have a presence there for sure. I don't know if all the offerings are going there just to support that church that's present there. But as a distributing point, again, that they are able, kind of like, you know, the Synod, right? We're able to give money to the Synod so that it can disseminate funds out to the rest of the world where we might not be as able to do that, or at least not quite as directly. Nowadays, it's a little easier with technology, again, to do that. Again, I don't know why it's doing that. Okay, it's back. But yeah, so I don't know exactly why, if all of it's going there for that purpose or what. Again, scriptures don't say much, so open to speculation. But
and then real quick, the tour was it leaving Antioch going to Tarsus that they had to go through the Taurus Mountains that they say were very difficult?
I guess
that was quite a deal for them to do.
Possibly.
And I don't know if it was going from there to Tarsus or when they left Tarsus they had to go through.
Let's see if it shows up. I know I saw that, there's the Taurus Mountains there. So that would make sense. It looks like it's on the west side of Tarsus, though, so as they're coming through here.
So it was when they left Tarsus.
It would be on the second missionary journey.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that they're heading up here. Is that the second? I don't think so. Yeah, they'd have to go through there to get to back that way. Rather than, again, that's, yeah, one of the decisions you got to make, right? You can take the land, so you're not risking your life on the sea, but then you got mountains and stuff to go through too, whereas the sea is smooth sailing, depending on the weather, of course. But, yeah, Joan?
Well, didn't they say, I don't know if it was the beginning of Acts or not, but that they took money to Jerusalem because people were in need there.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
well, there's,
I don't know what they were in need for, whether it was
taxes.
Food or
Roman taxes, really.
Yeah. Well, again, yeah, that's a central location for the church, but also for yeah, probably the headquarters as the capital of Israel, then yeah, a lot would go through there economically, socially. But also then there was that famine that took place throughout the land, and so they wanted to support the brothers down in Judea. And so a lot of the funds went at that time. I don't know if that continued on, though. How long that famine lasted, I don't think it was perpetual, of course. So initially, though, yeah, there was support that was being given to the church in Jerusalem because they needed it. But I don't think it would necessarily continue there unless they had it in their mind, well, this is the chief spot with the apostles, and we want to give it, it's our support. And from there, then they can give money out to the other missionaries and take them out to places that they need to go to, a distributing point again for help and support. Herb?
Wasn't Jesus' brother James the bishop of Jerusalem?
Yeah, so this is coming up in 15. He's the one that's in charge of the council that
the first one.
Meets there. Yeah, so he gets that actual title and actual role as opposed to Peter, who is a chief spokesman for the apostles, right? He will speak in Acts 15 about the gospel getting to the Gentiles, but ultimately the chief decision-making comes from James, who we assume then is the half-brother of Christ at that time, or at least the step-brother of Christ. It's not the brother of John, because he was executed back in Acts 12, I think it was. So we know that that's the case, and it probably wasn't the other. We don't know if James the Lesser is the same James, though, the brother of Jesus, right? So there's James, the son of Alphaeus. There's also James, the brother of Jesus. And so they might not all be the same. Well, it's a common name. James ultimately comes from the Greek word Yaakov, which is the Hebrew Jacob. So those two are connected as the transition would go. So Jacob, of course, would be a pretty common name for people at that time. But James is the Greek translation of that, or English translation of that. Okay, so James, you would think, yeah, James doesn't sound Hebrew, but Jacob does. They're both the same. Other questions, comments? Okay, so that does take us through the end of 14. Any other questions on 14 before we press on? I don't have a clock up there, so I can tell you whatever I want. It's only 10:30. So we'll keep moving on that into chapter 15. So let's read verses 1 through 5 to get it started. Dan, go ahead. Thank you.
But some men came down from Judea and were teaching to the brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And after Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with them, Paul and Barnabas and some of the others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and the elders about this question. So being sent on their way by the church, they passed through both Phoenicia and Samaria, describing in detail the conversion of the Gentiles, and brought great joy to all the brothers. When they came to Jerusalem, they were welcomed by the church and the apostles and the elders, and they declared all that God had done with them. But some believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees rose up and said, "It is necessary to circumcise them and to order them to keep the law of Moses."
All right, so are there denominations in Christianity already?
Yep.
Certainly sounds like it, right? Not the titles we would normally associate, but nonetheless, there are definitely differences. Okay, some men came down from Judea. Why coming down from Judea?
It was on a mountain.
We're teaching the brothers. Yeah, so Judea, the hilly country, right? In Jerusalem, you're always going down from Jerusalem, no matter where you're at, because it's the high place, the holy place. So coming down from Judea, teaching the brothers, saying, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Okay, so what is that statement all about?
Well, it's going back to Judaism.
Okay. Old Testament law.
Which we are.
Okay. Old Testament law? Well, yeah, specifically.
It's denying Jesus.
So
that
is.
Okay.
I think today we would consider it legalism.
Okay.
That you have to.
Yeah, it's not so much, I mean, if they said, we'd love for you to be circumcised, because that's how things went for us. And we think that's an important part of being a Christian. They're mandating it, right? Unless you are circumcised, you cannot be saved. So we don't prescribe that as a Christian church. If you're a Christian, well, sorry, you got to be circumcised. Well, what's the replacement for that in a certain sense, according to the book of Colossians?
The death and resurrection of Christ.
Well, yes, but baptism ultimately,
yeah.
Right? So baptism is now the new circumcision, or the circumcision of the heart that the Christian or the sinner needs, right? Not the physical cutting that would take place. So again, go back, Old Testament law is a blanket statement for all the different laws, but under that large blanket you have different categories of law. And those that are moral law definitely are still in play. Christ fulfills all those and keeps all those, but they're still applicable to every man, person, woman, and child around the world. Okay, the ceremonial law, though, that was given under Old Testament law is not applicable anymore because Christ fulfills that as the people of God himself. And that was meant for a certain people, along with the civil law, or the civic law, that was under that large blanket as well. That law, there are certain elements of it that are still connected with the moral law, and those elements that are still applicable and still required of people. Okay, but a lot of it is not still, or not considered moral law. Okay, so the idea of circumcision, that wasn't a moral thing. Okay, it wasn't saying you had to do this to show your moral purity. That was a physical mark God had to be put on his people to distinguish them from the rest of the cultures and tribes that were around. Okay, again, naturally, who would think that that was something that was a good thing to do in and of itself, to cut off the foreskin of the male member? Okay, that's not something that was naturally done. But God prescribes this as a way to show a distinction for his people. Okay. And so that's, again, a physical thing that is God attributes, and it's a connected thing. It's, at that time, you're given your name as a son on the eighth day to show your connection, now your belonging to the people of God. Okay, so it has definite significance and is not to be cast aside, but it's also not to be required by the Christian for the sake of salvation. Okay, and so this is the debate, and this is why it's an issue that comes up. Let's see if we can get that a little bigger there. Okay. Okay, so unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Okay, Joan? Okay.
Well, actually, I think the only thing that we have to be is buried with Christ in our baptism and raised to new life.
Okay. Faith alone saves, right? So none of these extra works are required or prescribed, or should be. Now, why is this an issue in the early church?
Because the Jews wanted it that way. It was really something they brought in and they were used to.
I think we can be a little more open or understanding of our, again, these are Christians that are requiring this. This isn't the Jews coming that are unbelieving in Jesus saying, you guys have to do this. These are Christians who believe in the gospel, but are saying if you really want to be a Christian as a Gentile, you must be circumcised. So we're not talking about cold-hearted, hard-hearted Jews who reject the Christ. We're talking about fellow brothers and sisters in Christ who have a new requirement that they're putting on the people of God. Yeah.
It was a sacred tradition to the people.
Right.
And it's something they didn't want to give up.
Right.
They liked this tradition. It's kind of like if somebody came along and said, okay, we can't celebrate Christmas anymore.
Okay.
No, we want to celebrate Christmas because that's our tradition.
Right. Yeah. So unless something comes along to teach them and guide them in a right way away from that, they have no reason to stop that at that point. Okay, because again, we just quoted what? To show that circumcision is now fulfilled or bettered by baptism. We quoted Colossians. Well, that hadn't been written yet. They didn't have that discussion yet. So again, what you're dealing with in the early church are all the effects of an early church. We're coming out of Judaism into Christianity. So what do we take with us and what do we leave behind? And that's what all this is about. This is why Luke records this in the book of Acts as a guide and a teaching point for the rest of the church still to come. Okay, but this is the birthing pains, right? They don't know what's supposed to, you know, God doesn't say in Jesus, or maybe Jesus teaches his disciples at some point this, but we don't have this written. Okay, exactly. Now, you're Christian, so you get rid of this, you keep this. We don't have that specifically laid out in the scriptures, at least not in the Old Testament, not in any word that we have in the Gospels of Jesus teaching his disciples. So now they're figuring, okay, well, how do you guide that discussion? How do you, as the early church, Christianity rooted in the gospel of Christ, how do you now go through all of these old customs and figure out what to keep and what to get rid of? What serves as your guide? Okay, well, what Christ said, but again, we don't know if he said anything about this specifically. So now they're left with trying to figure this out. What's their guide? It's the same guide we have in our lives as the church today. What do we say we should be doing or shouldn't be doing? What's our guide in that? As Christians, as Lutherans, it's the gospel. Whatever supports and emphasizes the grace of God in Christ Jesus, that's what we say we can't let go of. Everything else is adiaphora in that sense. Okay? And so we don't have these requirements. You can't eat this, you can't eat this, you can't do, it's the gospel. You are free in the gospel. Now there are things, of course, that will be better for you and not so good for you. And then common sense, wisdom, yeah, do those things, don't do those things. Okay? But we don't prescribe new laws for the sake of being, oh, you're a Christian, you gotta do things this way. And now there's, but again, good things and not so good things. But it's always the gospel. If something's gonna get in the way of the gospel, we get rid of it. We don't entertain it. Okay? And so that's got to be the guide here too. And that's what the discussion is going to come to. That's what Peter will ultimately say. Okay, but again, they're new to all this. This is a fresh thing for them. Okay, we're coming out of this Jewish faith, and Jesus fulfills all that Old Testament religion. If it was just Old Testament Yahwehism that they were dealing with, it wouldn't be so hard, I don't think. But it's not just Old Testament Yahwehism. It's the morphing, the evolution into Jesus' day Judaism. And what we can see is the roots of modern-day Judaism as well, which moves away from the gospel and again centers on the law. As we see here, the party of the Pharisees, right? All about the law, keeping things a certain way, prescription. Okay, Herb?
The early church did have the witness of Jesus' baptism.
Yeah. Okay.
The hope in the Lord's Supper.
Okay. Yeah, and so these things are present. Again, they're experiencing that, and that should be what they're rooted in. So baptism, of course, right? But again, all these early Christians were Jews, so they were also circumcised. Now we're branching out into the Gentiles who weren't circumcised. So we're trying to figure out, okay, so what part of this that we were and are now, do they need to be as well? Do we need to require that or not? Lord's Supper, of course. Now, you could argue, I don't think they ever do this, doesn't get to this extent, Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper in connection with the Passover. But there's never a prescription. Well, you got to be celebrating the Passover before you can have the Lord's Supper, right? But that would be something, I would think, that would follow the same flow as that of circumcision. Well, if you want to be a Christian, you got to do this. Well, if you want to be a Christian, you can't just have bread and wine. You got to have the full Passover to get the full effect. I think it helps in understanding, but that's never been the prescription. Okay, but again, what do we hold on to? What do we let go of as guided by the gospel of Christ? Yeah, Murph?
Unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. What does that say about the females?
Okay, now, this goes back.
That's the right purification, but it's only given to the males.
Okay, yeah, and this would go all the way back to the Old Testament, right? And so some of the, well, yeah, what about the females? What about girls? Well, what was the proclamation, the theology all about? We usually talk about only the males, right? The sons of God. And that's not to exclude the females. The women, they're included in all of that. Okay, but the men serve as the representation, the representative of all of the people. Okay, so that's kind of the inclusion. That's why still in the church, you know, or through the New Testament, you have the men as the head of the household. And that's kind of still the relationship that's supposed to exist. Okay? And still, I think why, again, we don't do this per se in the church, but for so long, even in the Lutheran church, women were not given the right to vote in the congregation. Well, what was that all about? It wasn't domineering. It's simply that theology from the scriptures that said the men were the head of the household. Doesn't mean the women weren't included. I would venture to guess all those men present at those voters' meetings, their wives knew about what was going on and had a say in what was going on in the congregation behind the scenes, right? Because I'm sure men and women in those days conversed with each other, right? I'm guessing. So they, you know, that mutual relationship that was there, even though they didn't get to speak in a meeting, didn't mean they didn't have their say in convincing of their husbands. Okay, so that's part of the relationship that was there. Yeah, so I think that's why, again, you don't have the focus on the women. It's not that they weren't included, but it was always about the transition from father to son, and that's where the line goes through. Again, going back to, it's Eve that commits the first sin, But it's only through the sin of Adam that all mankind is now sinful. Okay? And it's not, again, excluding Eve, but again, that Adam's the first. And so that's kind of how the lineage goes. Okay? Others on that.
Well, actually, I remember when they, I'm old, yes, but I remember when they, you couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm. Right. And some Missouri Synod churches still have that as part of their, kind of, just a few, not a lot. I know when I was a vicar, and this was early 2000s, a congregation in Central California split over that issue. Some wanted to hold on to that, that women weren't permitted to vote, and others said, no, they should, and they couldn't reconcile, and so they divided. And that was in Central California. Talk about beat bastion of liberalism, and yet there are those there who are still holding on to those more traditional values. Again, I don't think we have we have to be careful how much we allow society to influence the church. Okay? But we can also learn from the society in a sense, too, to see, okay, what is truly valuable, what is God-pleasing, and what is scriptural in that sense. So we have to evaluate these things on a regular basis. Is it wrong that women vote in the congregation now? I don't think so. And I think understanding Paul's prescription that women should not be permitted to teach is more the in connection with the office of the ministry and not so much, women can't speak in the church. That's not permitted. No, it's regarding a position of authority that they're not permitted to be pastors in essence. It's still that office of the ministry. So not, again, less than that. There's other areas. Of course, women are very influential in the New Testament, the Scriptures, all in the Old Testament. They're never excluded, but the focus is usually on the male because that's how the gospel of the salvation gets passed down. You have to be a son of God to be the inheritor of his kingdom. And in baptism, we're all sons of God, okay, even though we're women. And we still do that in our confession of the faith, right? That who for us then... And for our salvation came down from heaven. Well, we don't add women to that. But I think the women are okay with that, right? You know that includes you, right? You're not, hey, why do we do that? Some churches say that. Well, no, we got to add women. Some have done that. Who for us people and for our salvation. So they will modify that. But again, it's us doing the mental. We can work with that. We understand. And we're taught. We're educated rather than dumbing it down. Yeah.
I'll date myself and remember the voters assembly when we gave the women the right to
vote. Yeah.
Oh, your fault. Huh?
Right.
I always blame Bill Oswald.
And I just had somebody, I think it was at this LLL convention, talk about how they remembered when the pews were divided.
Yeah,
women on one side, women on the other.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, that was very common too. But like, well, what's the point of that?
Well, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
They had small children on that side.
Uh huh.
And the men were on that side. So if they needed to nurse the babies, they were over on the other side of the church.
But you could still be distracted, I'm sure. So it wasn't like, oh, that kept you from being distracted. But yeah. Anyway, this is interesting, right? How? Why does this come up? Why do we do things that way? Good.
Christianity is the only religion in the world that your forgiveness of sins and salvation mm-hmm. is absolutely free.
Mm-hmm.
All the other religions are something you've got to do
right.
in order to be saved.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, that's again, there's only one done religion, that's Christianity. In its truest sense, the purest sense. Okay. Everything else is, you have to do it or don't do something to earn that enlightenment, that reward, or whatever. Chief distinction. Yeah, Bonnie?
I was just thinking that so many of the issues that we deal with nowadays on, well, say, sex before marriage, things like that,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of society that says, you guys just need to let all that.
Yeah.
It's just not,
Yeah.
But if, like you said, we always go back to the Bible and what it tells us to do, then
mm-hmm.
we know we don't need to let all that.
Right. Yep, and that's, it can be isolating, feel alone, but we're not. So long as we all hold to that, right? And we're unified in that, we're not alone. And even if we were, doesn't make it right. Right is right regardless of who believes it. And that's again, what our society doesn't usually understand. Young people, it's majority rule or whatever I think is right or whatever. That's a scary thought. And that's what I think Congressman Shimkus pointed out too. quoting back from Judges, everyone did what they thought was right in their own eyes. And that's kind of where we're at with society in a lot of ways. And that's, again, a scary thing. And so somebody goes into a school and starts shooting, well, that's what I thought was right. How do you argue against that? Well, you got to go to objective law, but then you got to do that in other areas too, and people don't like that. But since when was governance all about getting people to like things? You know, governance is supposed to be about doing what's best and what's right for everybody, what's good, not about what makes me feel good, right? I know getting punished, spanked didn't feel good, but it was good because it kept me from getting myself into trouble, right? So, you know, again, it's not what the initial gratification, but the long term, what is truly good. That's the tough thing, because it's, so who was just saying that delayed gratification, right? The sign of maturity isn't that you can instantly gratify yourself, but that you're able to wait to be, you know, receive that goodness. Say, okay, I've earned that, or, you know, don't have to have it all right now. Yeah, Dan?
I don't know what percentage of Christianity the Lutherans are, maybe 2 or 3% of the total number of Christians that claim to be Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like in the Lutheran Church, it's still about the only denomination that focuses on that faith alone, grace alone, mm-hmm. word alone, because, you know, in the Reformers, they say, well, you're okay, but you have to make your decision for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's now a requirement that, you know, was laid on you. I have to do this.
Yeah.
Catholic Church has a lot of mm-hmm. things that they add on to the grace.
Right.
So, you know, thank God for this church body
mm-hmm.
that says
mm-hmm.
grace alone, faith alone, word
yeah.
alone.
Yeah. I think one of the probably the most potent questions you can ask any Christian is, how sure are you that you'll be saved? And if they answer anything less than 100%, then you know they're not Lutheran. Okay. Now, they may say, oh, I'm 100% sure. Well, why is that? Well, because I feel it in my heart. Well, okay. You feel that all the time? Yeah, you get into those issues, right? But that's, I mean, Pentecostal, you've got to speak in tongues if you want to know for sure you've got the Spirit. Okay? Well, I don't speak in tongues all the time, so how do I know I'm always saved? If it's always based on the person, the individual, then there's no certainty. That's why if salvation, objectively, it's on Christ, you can always be certain, because that doesn't change. He's always good and successful. Yeah, heard?
Did sin start on earth, or was it the angels?
I think it starts with the fall of the angels,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have an impact on this world or this creation until Adam sins.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and that's what the scriptures say, through one man, all have sinned, not through the angel, right? So again, I think this is where, even, you know, maybe that's an argument too for the superiority of man over the angels, right? Because Satan, Lucifer didn't like the idea that God would bring salvation through mankind, and you can have the angels fall and yet still not have everything ruined yet. But once Adam sins, then it's all, that's when the curse comes in. Yeah.
Angels were the source of the devil.
Well, sure. Yeah, it's Lucifer, Satan was an angel, the scriptures talk about. So, and we say usually there that, again, we assume they're part of the creation, that they're not eternal before they were created. But they had a time of testing. We don't know how long that was, or, you know, because if they're created in the 6 days of creation, that doesn't give much time for their creation to their fall, and then from man's creation to his fall. I mean, we don't know. It's a little tough to ponder that. Because scriptures make it sound like it's pretty, you know, close together in the timing. But it could have been longer, you know, that the man lived in perfection. But there's no children yet, right? The first child that's conceived is Cain, and that's once this fall has occurred. I can't imagine that they were able to live a couple years in perfection without any children being born. So that's usually where I would say, well, it probably happened pretty quickly. And the devil wants to capitalize on his own fall. You know, gives an opportunity with the man and woman in the garden. You know, throw my poison out there, see if they bite, and then things take off from there. So yeah, it's tough to call and figure out the timing of all that. But yeah, did man have to sin? No. Yeah, the resistance should have been there against the devil. and it should have been solely based on the word of God. And the devil gave Eve the opportunity. Did God really say that if you touch of it? No, he didn't. Goodbye. Done. Move on. But, oh, Malia, you're right. Okay, well, yeah, I can't imagine. Gosh, it's a piece of fruit. Just like anything else in all the trees, how can it really be that bad, right? You rationalize. And then, well, at that point, of course, they eat. And that's not yet. It's not until Adam eats, right, that their eyes are open. They realize then that they're naked. That's the moot point question. But what happens if Adam had resisted and Eve had sinned? You know, what would have happened then?
Sooner or later, somebody would have sinned.
Well, yeah. But Adam, what if he had, you know, if God, if he passed the test and Eve didn't, what would have taken place? Would Adam's righteousness in that regard covered his wife's? We don't know. It's an interesting, but again, a moot point, because Adam does fall, and they are one flesh, as God has instituted in marriage. So, I guess it's bound to happen, but Adam can't use that. Well, I had to do it because Eve did it, but yeah, it's tough. And we'll have those answers maybe sorted out once we're perfected. But
what does it mean, Pastor, when it says that the woman's pain in childbearing will increase, and that's the result of sin?
Right.
Was there children born before that that weren't with, born with such pain? I mean,
yeah.
Why do you have it to compare it to? If
I know. Yeah, that's another tough one. That I don't know if there would have been pain in childbirth before the fall. Because you think, well, it's perfection. There wouldn't be any pain or suffering.
No.
But it would be, and that's where you could argue, well, that to be increased, well, going from 0 to 100 is increasing. So it's not that it was in existence pain before, but in a similar sense, the challenging question comes when Adam is given the command by God, do not eat of it, for the day you eat of it, you will surely. Well, what to him is death? There's been no death yet. He doesn't know. So does he understand that? I mean, this hasn't happened yet, but God knows. So the knowledge of good and evil from the tree obviously would give him that knowledge. But maybe, I mean, they're perfect in their understanding and their knowledge, at least their human minds. I'm sure they're still limited, but perhaps they had a concept. Well, this is life. What would death be? You know, the opposite, or the taking away of that life. So maybe there's some comprehension. I don't know. But again, they had never experienced that death. And so the woman probably never experienced pain or would have in childbirth either. So some, maybe that's what they'll argue with Mary. When Jesus is conceived in her womb and when he's born, some believe, even some Lutherans believe, that Mary was not defiled in the birthing process. That is, she didn't give birth in the normal way. That Jesus was able to come forth out of her without passing through the normal process. Again, that's maybe to help preserve that divine, perfect nature of Jesus, and to show this is what childbirth really could have been like. I don't know. Again, there's not any biblical evidence for that, so it's speculation. But all that kind of based off of the what if, you know, the moot point questions. Like, oh, well, it'd be interesting to know. But we don't, and it didn't happen. It's not going to happen, so I guess we have to wait and ultimately find out.
God wanted us to know.
Yeah, he wants us to know a lot of things that aren't in the Bible, though. So he could have, you know, revealed that. Okay, but yeah, especially something like that, pre-knowledge or before the fall, you can't learn that from creation itself. So you got to have the revelation of God's word there. All right, so I don't know how we got to that point. All right, but good. So they do come to Jerusalem, they're welcomed by the church, the apostles and the elders, they declared all that God had done with them. But some believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees rose up and said, it's necessary to circumcise them to order them to keep the law of Moses. So again, that's the party of the Pharisees. Pharisees well known for their keeping of the law. That was what Paul belonged to himself before he was converted. So maybe that was one of his own denomination at the time, but probably not so much the case. So the apostles, the elders were gathered together to consider this matter. Took a lot of conversation, I'm sure. We don't know, have the time frame of all this, but after there had been much debate, Peter does stand up, say to them, brothers, you know that in the early days God made a choice among you, that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe. And God, who knows the heart, bore witness to them by giving them the Holy Spirit just as he did to us. And he made no distinction between us and them, having cleansed their hearts by faith. Now, therefore, why are you putting God to the test by placing a yoke on the neck of the disciples that neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear. But we believe that we will be saved through the grace of the Lord Jesus, just as they will. I think that's, again, the key that Peter understands, which is the heart of the gospel. That is what needs to guide all these further discussions when it comes to whatever crops up from the law. Okay? Especially if there's going to be, people are going to claim there's got to be done this way, the gospel's got to trump that, dictate what's truly the way of salvation. Okay? And this came up in Luther's time. The Baptists still to this day say you've got to be baptized through immersion for it to be a real baptism. And some church websites still say that. If you look at their doctrine, their statement of faith. And if you're not baptized through immersion, it doesn't count. Well, that's similar to this, right? Well, unless you're circumcised, you can't be saved. Unless you're immersed, you're not truly a Christian. Sorry, that's not what the scriptures teach.
And you have to be older, too.
Well, yeah, that's... They don't usually state that quite so clearly, but that's assumed from their overall theology. But the mode is definitely, or not always, but a lot of times it's stated. You've got to be dunked. You've got to be immersed. Well, that's the same idea. We're requiring a certain thing in order for there to be true salvation.
And you don't have any sins until you're 14.
Well, that's age of accountability is relative, right? So, yeah, that's some will believe that, yeah. They say
next,
that, yeah.
Next time, could you explain a little bit about yoke, putting God to the test, what is meant by that?
Yep. We'll pick up there. I went through that paragraph quickly. We'll go back and address those things more specifically. Just so we'll pick up there with 6 next time, and we'll definitely deal with that idea of the yoke that's being placed on them, how they're not able to be. Okay. Yes.
And also, we notice Peter. Now, where has Peter been?
Where was Peter been? Who knows?
Back to chapter 11.
Yeah, I mean, he was down away from Jerusalem somewhat in the vicinity in Judea, right? He's been into the different areas following in Joppa, right? And what was the other one? Joppa and something with an L. Anyway, he was in those areas, but he's back in Jerusalem, probably with the other apostles there too. Again, they're the ones in charge of the church. They've got the deacons that are doing these other outreach ministries. Now they've got missionaries going out into the different parts of the world. We don't know. We don't get a lot from Luke on exactly what the other apostles are doing. Okay, but they are here, and they've all met in Jerusalem for the purpose now of discussing, how do we deal with this concept of circumcision? Because Peter will say, we didn't send these guys to you to confront you with this teaching on circumcision. And so we want the churches to know this isn't authorized by us, and this is our answer to that. And this is why the council's meeting here, to get this straightened out and to have authority, right? To dictate to the church, now this is what we are to be teaching and believing. Okay? And it's coming from the apostles, who should be viewed as authorities in the church. And Paul, of course, he'll challenge Peter later on. We don't hear really anybody else challenging Peter, right? But Paul, of course, believes he's just as authoritative as those guys are. And then, for the most part, agree. But there'll be a challenge coming up that Paul has to do with Peter, because Peter here states this, right? But he'll flip-flop later on. And he'll say just the opposite. Well, now these guys have to be circumcised. And Paul's going to say, what are you talking about? And yet Paul will circumcise... Is it Timothy, but not Titus, right? Okay. Because again, it's not about the actual act itself, but what does this communicate to certain people? Okay, if you want to be in with these people, then there are certain things you got to do in the freedom of a Christian, not because you have to for your salvation, but for the benefit of others. And that's the difference here. They're requiring this for salvation and not just for the sake of love and concern for a brother or sister in Christ. Because that will also then determine kind of what's coming up as an aftermath of this, to the letter that the church sends out. Okay. And we'll talk more about that next time. Next week is Holy Week. I'm totally fine with meeting, though, on Tuesday, if you would like to do that. Yes, no, show of hands. Well, let's do it. It's fine.
We need it.
Yeah, I'll need a break from all that.
We really don't get started until Thursday anyway.
What?
We don't really get started until Thursday.
Right. Yeah, so no church Wednesday. So.
He doesn't have anything else to do.
He doesn't have anything else to do.
So we'll just do that. We'll meet next Tuesday as well. It's the last Tuesday of the month anyway, so don't want to miss that. Come with other questions, concerns. If you have questions about the Lord's Supper or the crucifixion of Christ next week, that's a good time to talk about it since it is Holy Week. But we'll move more into this too.
Bible study?
Yeah. And we should be in the fellowship hall. I don't think anything else is going on. Sorry, I didn't tell you about that last week. I totally forgot about this, so. But thank you for being flexible. All right, we can stand and sing our doxology. Praise.